Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Lolo, only on LA Talk Radio.
Guitar, an amazing instrument. It has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro and welcome to All About Guitar, where we talk tone, we talk technique, we talk gear. Where we discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies. Where we take a good look at everything guitar. And sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important. So we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to All About Guitar. We have a great show for you. I am truly honored to have tonight Marcella Detroit, amazing singer-songwriter and guitarist. I mean, she co-wrote Lay Down Sally with Eric Clapton, and she's played with like the who's who's of music. Aretha Franklin did a duet with Elton John, one of my favorites, George Duke, and another one of my favorites, Stanley Clarke, Bob Seger. And she's written songs for Al Jarreau, Chaka Khan, Rita Coolidge, and Belinda Carlisle, among others. So I want to thank her and welcome her to the show, and also Lori again.
Hello.
Who brought this, who put this all together.
Yay.
So, hey, hi, everybody.
Welcome.
Thank you, Lori.
So we're going to talk a little bit tonight about guitar in context with her songwriting and stuff. She does a lot of stuff, and she plays more than one instrument. But let's start a little bit from the beginning. Let's get a little bit of background where you, where your influences are, besides songwriting, but also guitar-wise.
Well, as far as influences go, you know, the Beatles were like a big thing for me. But growing up, I was always interested in music from the time I was a child. And my father, he played the ukulele and he taught me how to play. He used to run around the house singing at the top of his lungs songs like Detour, There's a Muddy Road Ahead. And he'd pick up the ukulele and set it on the couch, and my mom would come in the room and sit on the ukulele and break it into a million pieces.
Oh.
That happened about four or five times, and there no more ukuleles. But he always encouraged my music. And from the minute I could sing and understand music, I don't know, I just had, I think some people are just born with this desire, this affinity towards music. That was me. My father saw it, and he encouraged me from a very early age. We sang harmonies together. And when it came time for me, when I joined school, I was in school plays, choruses, choirs, you know, you name it, just like everything, did shows on my own. And when it came time to pick an instrument, I said, I really wanted to play the harp. I was completely fascinated with the harp, you know, Groucho Marx and that whole thing. Well, I love those movies, but the harp just mesmerized me. I wanted to play it, but my parents were like, it's too big and too expensive, so pick something else. So I picked the violin. So that was my first instrument, and my father took me to see the great violinist Isaac Stern
when
I was about 8 years old. Yeah, and he took me. I had he took me to see the movie Fantasia, and I had the Tchaikovsky, you know, Nutcracker Suite, and I used to dance around my house to that. But I grew up in Detroit, so I grew up with Motown, You know, that was, I always had a transistor radio in my ear, and my parents loved music, so they always had a radio on in the car or at home, and it was always like top 40 Motown. You know, we were inundated with it at school, like I said, in the car, you know, in the lunch cafeteria, you know. I mean,
it was a lifestyle, right?
It was a lifestyle, absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I used to walk to school listening to Stevie Wonder on my transistor. Remember that transistor, the smell of that leather case. it was an amazing time for music, you know.
So let me ask you, though, when you were a little kid, your parents had music on the house all the time?
All the time.
Yeah,
they loved music.
Yeah. So we when I was in school, they did a study about that, and the earlier you listen, the quicker you start picking up, and you'll start a lot of the. They study child prodigies, and a lot of them at early age were listening and exposed to music at very early age.
Oh, even before they're born.
Yeah, that's true.
Probably
too.
Seen that. Yeah.
So your family, that's all that music. That's great.
Yeah, my dad loved it, and he was also an artist, you know, fine artist, which he gave up. But my mother loved it, although she didn't really have much. I think she wasn't tone deaf, but my father was the one who had it. And I only found out later on in life that my great-grandfather was a concert violinist. I don't know why my dad didn't tell me that a long time ago when I chose the instrument. Anyway, it was an interesting little, you know, bit of information that I gravitated towards that. And then after that, it was the Beatles changed my world. I thought, I got to get a guitar. You know, my first love was George Harrison, so I just thought, I gotta get a guitar. I wanna do that. You know, and I saw the Beatles too when I was 12.
Oh wow! Yeah. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, when I was 12, I went to a dodgy area of Detroit, and my parents let me go with another friend of mine named Marcy. Her name was Marcy Brown, and we took a bus down to this really dangerous area of Detroit, and the Beatles. I mean, I just couldn't wait to get there and see them. And we got in, there were 15,000 girls at Olympia Stadium, and all I wanted to do was hear the Beatles, but all I heard was and I was thinking to myself, honestly, I was sitting in that balcony and I was thinking all the girls, shut up. I could barely hear them over the din.
Yeah.
But it left an indelible impression on me. Like, oh my God, that's what I want to do. Little did I know that years later I would meet them all one by one.
Oh, that's great.
And actually stay in one of their houses to do an album. But we can talk about that in a little while if you want, or whatever.
Oh, the suspense.
Well, before we get into that, so what was your first guitar?
Well, my first acoustic guitar was a 12-string. Funnily enough.
So wow. you got an acoustic first.
Yeah, it kills your fingers, man. If it's not set up right, the action was pretty high. But I guess maybe that helped me because I have like these calluses that must be an inch thick, I swear. But it was a Goya 12-string that my father bought me. I don't even know if they make guitars anymore. But I loved it. You know, it was like my best friend. You know, it was like whenever I felt bad, or, you know, sad or just emotional, I needed a friend. I picked up my guitar. I'd go in my room and lock myself in my room and sing and play for at least an hour, and I'd feel so much better. After that, you know, I wanted to get more into, like, electric guitar. So my dad bought me, he was very encouraging. He bought me this Japanese guitar, which it wasn't a well-known brand, but it was called a Kenora, and it was a like a dark burgundy finish. And he bought me a little amp, too. I used to go down the street and sing, like, Standell's songs, you know, and Rolling Stones, Satisfaction. It was so funny, but it was such a great release. I just was immediately gravitated towards it.
So besides the Beatles, who else influenced you, especially if you were doing finger picking? I presume on the 12-string you were finger picking?
Yeah, well, I mean, I went through a whole folk blues era, you know, like Lead Belly, but a guy named Fred Neil, you know, Fred Neil, he was, you know, he wrote the Nielsen song, Everybody's Talking at Me. Mm-hmm. And so I learned some of Fred Neil's songs. He had an album called, I think it was called Dolphin Street, or there was a song on there. It's such an amazing album. And to hear his version, he was real hardcore kind of bluesy, folky singer and writer. And that song put him on the map when Nielsen did his song. Great song. And his
and then Glenn Campbell did it, too.
That's right.
Because we just did it in our show.
Yeah.
Our Wrecking Crew show.
Right. Right. Yeah. So then I got into that, you know, like I said, Lead Belly and all the blues artists, you know, Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee. I mean, even, you know, kind of dabbled into jazz when my boyfriend was really into, like, serious jazz, you know, like John McLaughlin and Pharoah Saunders. And I appreciate that kind of music. I really appreciate it. Not that I've done it myself, but I've kind of, like, done some kind of scatting. You know, I've done a few shows in England where I was playing with this amazing pianist. So I've always, I just love music, but I think the root of what I love and what I've drawn to, what I'm drawn to comes from soul and blues. I would say those are my strongest roots, and it just kind of branches out from there. But I love embracing new things, new styles, you know.
Well, was there a big folk and blues scene in Detroit?
Well, there was a blues scene. We had this one club called the Chessmate that I used to sneak into. I stole my parents' car. It was cool because I had, in my bedroom, I had a door that, you know, that was open to the backyard. And so when I was about 16, my parents were asleep. It was about midnight, and John Lee Hooker was playing at this place called the Chessmate. So I thought, I'll wait till they're asleep. I'll sneak out, steal the car, and go down to this another very dangerous area. And I got in with fake ID, and I don't know what I was thinking, but really it was scary. But I just sat there in awe, like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm witnessing this. I was very brave back in the day. Not so much now, but I'm glad I was brave, because there were some incredible experiences. You know,
yeah, that's a once in a lifetime to see something like that.
Yeah,
that's amazing. Yeah. So that was an interesting scene then. You had a lot of influences then there. It was a lot of stuff coming in that you were listening to.
Yeah, but I guess if you were to analyze it, it's mostly about what's raw, what's really accessible and emotional. That is what drew me in. You know, the real deal kind of stuff. But as I got older, then I started to get into, I went through a phase where I liked more alternative, kind of rocky stuff, like Ozzy Osbourne, you know, and that whole scene. I love David Bowie. I still love him, because that stuff to me is just so pure and is so real. You know, there's nothing phony about it. I mean, to me, Bowie was like one of the absolute greats. So I loved
Absolutely.
Him as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there was a lot of stuff even after the Beatles that the British invasion continued.
Right. Yeah. So, they were great artists.
Yeah.
Great bands.
So, well, let's talk a little bit. You had mentioned that there's a story. I want to hear a little bit about Lay Down Sally, what happened, and the different versions. I'll let you just explain it.
All right. Well,
and then I'll play the clip.
Maybe I should preface it by saying that was like the third, kind of my third little step up when I made a conscious decision that this is what I'm going to do with the rest of my life. When I was 18, I was sitting in a park, and I just looked up at the sky, singing and playing, going, okay, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. So I put on my blinders, and I ended up being in Bob Seger's band. And then after that, I moved to Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I got into, because of that connection, joined Eric Clapton's band. But first I worked with Leon Russell, and he was also one of my major influences, part of the Wrecking Crew as well. I worked with him, and then because of that whole Tulsa connection, then I ended up working with Eric, because I moved there and all my friends got to join his band. I did a stint with Leon for about a year on the road, and on one album of his called Stop All That Jazz with the Gap Band. And my friends said, okay, well, when you're done with that, come and join us with Eric, because they did the 461 Ocean Boulevard album. So after that, they invited me down to Jamaica, and 5 days later, Eric said, I sang on a few songs, says, would you like to be in the band? And I said, well, yeah, what was I, crazy? Of course I want to be in the band. So, yeah, be with all my friends and tour the world. I mean, it's kind of a no-brainer, you know.
So somewhere in there you figured out, like, you have this voice that, I mean, you have this amazing range and timbre and just beautiful. People started to notice that besides your musicianship, your singing. I mean,
yeah, thank you.
Something really special about her singing, you know.
Thanks. I mean, well, it was because, you know, when I was in my first bands in the Detroit area, because they were so loud, I realized that because I naturally had kind of an alto voice when I was younger, you know, but I realized that I have a range, and that was the best way to be heard. If you can sing higher than what's going on with the band, then you're going to be heard. So I ended up developing my higher range, and yeah, that's how that happened, only because of, you know, out of necessity, really, and desire, mm-hmm. you know. So yeah, I was in Clapton's band. I was actually in his band twice, but the first time, we were in England recording. I think this was like the fourth album that I was on with him, the Slow Hand album, and we were in this iconic studio called Olympic.
Yes, Olympic Studios.
Great studio, and Glyn Johns was producing, and we were there, I don't know, it was a few weeks. We'd already been there a few weeks. And, you know, in those days, you could just go in and take your time, write songs on the spot.
Well, with Eric, yeah.
With Eric, yeah.
You just did whatever you needed to do.
Exactly. So Eric came in one day and he said, "Hey, Marcy, I'd like to write a song called Lay Down Sally." And I went, "Oh, I don't know where it came from. But to me, I love to work with titles because they evoke... There's something about a good title that evokes a melody immediately to me. Mm-hmm. It has a certain cadence about it. I don't know. Something about it, I just kind of reached out of the air. And we were very much into Little Feat and New Orleans kind of second line style back then. So believe it or not, the song really started by me saying, okay, yeah, I picked up a guitar that was in the studio and I just started playing like that. It came up, lay down, Sam. Still in my arms. Don't you think you want someone to talk to?" So that's kind of how it started.
Mm-hmm.
We worked on the song all day long like that, as you know, that version. And Eric got bored. The keyboard player left. And then all of a sudden, Eric started playing that iconic riff, which some people have said, "Well, that sounds like a J.J. Cale song." Well, maybe, but it goes back way before J.J. Cale, you know, like a hand jive kind of thing, or,
right.
You know. So we just laid it down like that. George Terry and Eric and I worked on that chorus. We got the chorus to where we liked it. We could not come up with the verse with that groove. So, like I said, Eric came up with the groove, and Glyn was like, "Okay, everybody, we got to record it now because it was sounding really good." Everybody kind of manned their stations. The keyboard player left, so I was like, "Okay, I'll get on the electric piano." And if you hear the part, it's like really simplistic. It's just me. I'm like, I'm not really much of a piano player. I can't play it, but, you know. So we recorded it, and then Eric said to me, "Okay, go back to your hotel tonight and write the rest of the lyrics and the melody for the verses." So I came back the next day, and we recorded it, laid it down, and a few months later, you know, we were on tour, and the manager kept coming in the, you know, backstage going, "Hey, song's number, you know, 25 in the charts." We're like, "Wow, really? Okay." And then, you know, the last time it was number 4, and it went gold, which we were all really pleasantly surprised with. That was cool.
Now, this version that I have,
yeah,
is it pretty much what the original groove is, or is this a different...
No, I think I sent you a version, like a ballad version, which is, I was messing around with a friend of mine, a bass player named Richard Grossman, and he said, "Oh, I've done this song, kind of like a version of Blue Bayou, you know, like that Linda Ronstadt song," and he showed me on the bass what he was thinking about, so we came up with a whole other version of it. I've done it many different ways. But.
Well, let's go ahead and play the clip. And then you can tell us a little more what you were doing on there.
Cool.
So this is this is Lay Down Sally.
Sunny, dearly on the rise.
Now, I want to point out, too, as you hear different clips, the style of your voice is totally different for the different songs. Which is amazing. It shows the versatility, because that's a total different sound than some of the other stuff in the that sent me, the clips.
Yeah.
That's a beautiful arrangement. That's really, really nice. And I like the little scat up on the top of that, in that little part.
Thanks.
And but now, the which guitar were you using on that one?
Oh, gosh. That was when I was doing my Jewel album on London Records after I finished with my band Shakespeare Sister. So that was probably not this Martin, which has an incredible story of its own, but it was probably another one of my Martins, because I'm really a Martin girl at heart.
How many Martins do you have?
Well, I had three, but now I only have two. Yeah.
So you have this one, which is an orchestra. Do you have a dreadnought?
I do have a dreadnought, yeah. Well, actually, I used to have a dreadnought, a D-28, but I got rid of it a few years ago. But I do have a Martin guitar, an acoustic electric that I use, called a SPDC-16R. Mm-hmm. It's a fantastic gig guitar. You know, it's not as like valuable as this guitar. This is a 1949 0018 that was actually purchased for me by Eric Clapton. Eric said we were on tour in San Francisco area. We had a day off, and he came in the room where we were all hanging out and said, I'm going guitar shopping. Anyone want a guitar? And I'm like, well, yes, please. Can you please bring me back a really nice little Martin? And so he brought this back for me, and it's like awesome. My prized possession. I did had it wired for sound. It's got one of those LR bags pickups in it, which is pretty good. However, I didn't really try it out enough for when I did this one gig, and I wasn't getting enough gain. So if I ever do decide to use it again, I'm going to have to do some modifications. But it's a beautiful guitar, and I've used it to record and to accompany me.
Well, it's interesting because his Eric Clapton model is this style. It's the double
right.
lot.
Yeah.
So he really liked that smaller body.
Yeah.
And they really they're really great for recording because they're not as deep. The dreadnoughts are made for live. They're made to strum.
Yeah.
This is a little lighter, but it works well in recording. It fits in the pocket.
It's so beautiful and warm. I just love it.
Now, I just want to talk a little bit about your playing, because you're kind of doing a little finger picking thing on that lay down.
Yeah, yeah. It's just, it starts out with like this. Going out of tune. Yeah, just something like that.
It works really well, and it's a nice little, because I think, If I'm correct, there's just the one guitar, and you're singing the bass, and then it sounds like there's a cello back there or something.
There's all kinds of stuff. I mean, I think it was like, well, we have the technology, so let's use it. Chris Thomas produced that record that I did, and we had a great guy to work with who was doing the kind of programming. But
well, while you're tuning that guitar, tell us the story behind that guitar. Besides that, he bought that.
You said that's the story.
Yeah. That's the story.
Yeah, that's the story.
That's
that he
amazing.
Bought it for me, and I've just cherished it ever since. It needs to be dusted off, but that kind of adds to the character, I think.
It's a great guitar.
Thanks.
I'm going to show now. I'm going to play another clip, and it's a total different groove, and it kind of I think shows that the Detroit influence. And this one's called the Good Woman Down from the Vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm correct, you're doing all the guitars on this.
I'm not doing all the guitars, no.
Okay, so you got to tell me what you're doing, because there's some amazing stuff in this.
Oh, thanks.
Let me play this one. This is Good Woman Down. Take a listen. I love this feel. Good groove.
It's a disappointment. It really hurts, but I
and actually do what they said they would do. Cause once you stop believing, you're through. Now it's up to me to make my dream come true. Because you can't keep a good girl.
Totally different feel. Now that guitar, that's junk, junk. That's you.
Mine is the. Yeah, and then the chorus is a little more complicated.
Who's on the other guitar?
Huh?
Who's on the other guitar?
I have Johnny Lee Shell.
Johnny Lee Shell. Yeah. It's a great, what you guys are doing together just really works.
And that's James Gatson on the drums.
And James Gatson
our good
on
friend.
Drums. And Reggie McBride on
Reggie
the bass.
McBride.
And let's
beautiful.
See. A guy named Luke Miller. Really
oh, great.
Great keyboard player. Yeah, yeah.
And you're doing all the vocals?
No, I had a girl named Diane Lotney join me on the background vocals.
We know Diane.
Yeah, yeah. She joined me on those. And that is a record that I produced back in 2012. 2011,
mm-hmm. 2012. She sang or still sings with Dr. John, right?
Huh?
She sings with
she
Dr.
Did.
John?
Yeah, I
or
think
did?
She did.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, that's a great, I mean, totally different feel, but it captures that kind of funky, kind of a Motown type of
exactly.
Guy.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, yeah. That was, I handpicked all those people to play on it
very
for that
soulful.
Reason. Yeah, because I wanted to do, I wanted to get back to my soul roots. Because previously, I think I kind of went off on a tangent that, okay, what am I doing here? Once in a while, you know, I like to embrace the new, but then I have to, like, get back to my roots to mm-hmm. just kind of center myself. And that was done deliberately because I just wanted to get back to my roots and explore, you know, my funky influences and did that record.
No, it's great. Now, what guitar did you use on that one?
Actually played this. I played this. I played acoustic doing my rhythm part.
Okay,
yeah.
So that was acoustic guitar.
Yeah.
Then what was he with the other guitars?
I think he was using a Telecaster.
That's a Tele.
Yeah.
That's an interesting sound. It was really good. Yeah. I mean, it worked. Now, as a producer, as the songwriter-producer, how much latitude did you give them, or were you pretty specific what you wanted?
Well, I think it's always good to trust the people that you hire. If you hear something that is maybe not exactly what you're feeling or what you want, I mean, you can explain to them, look, I want it to be more of a definite part. It can't be too jammy. I want it to have more of something more concise. And I think I mentioned something about that. You know, we play it through a few times, then we reel it, then I kind of have to, you know, if you're wearing all these hats, you kind of have to step back.
Yeah,
and be able to detach from it a little bit, and say, well, no, I think can we just try to make this part more concise, or here's what I want here, and yeah, it's just kind of a process.
Though it seems to me that if you played that guitar part, that kind of defined the song, the groove.
Pretty much, yeah.
That
yeah.
groove, that and the little fills that you're doing, the
right.
little trick, the turnarounds.
Yeah, yeah.
It's really. Very tasty, but I mean, it really kind of sets it up.
Well, Steve Cropper, I mean, you know, he's one of my biggest influences, aside from George Harrison.
Well, we were going to talk a little bit. You had brought some pictures about that. Which, is there a song that was from those sessions?
Yes. In fact, the...
Because I'll play that clip, and then we'll go
sure.
into this a little bit.
Play that, when we did that record... Do you want me to tell what we're talking
sure,
about,
sure,
where
sure.
we were? Yeah, I think I mentioned previously, too, that I did, when I was in Shakespeare Sister for our second album, Hormonally Yours, we recorded it at George Harrison's home studio in Friar Park. Yeah, and I felt so privileged because I am, Lori just handed me this picture that we took. There were 59 guitars on the wall I mean, you can see there are like, there are loads of Fenders, but there are also these really cool Gretches, and I got to play one of those.
So you played the Gretsch on this cut?
Yeah, for the solo, I played the Gretsch.
And it sounds like a fuzz guitar lead. So what were you using?
Well, we mic'd it up. I was using, I think it was, he had a country gentleman. Now, that was a guitar.
The guitar.
But we had a Vox amp that he had used at Shea Stadium. And so I used
that. Was it
that.
The small one, the combo, or the big one?
It wasn't huge. It was pretty small.
It's probably, yeah. I think it'd be an AC-30.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it was, yeah.
So what did you use as a distortion device? You must have had a...
Well, back then, I used to use this thing that kind of had all the sounds built into it. It was called the GP8.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was.
So you used your own pedal.
Yeah, I had my own pedals and created my own
sounds.
I'm
just curious if he had, he had some vintage Buzz tones.
I didn't know, no, because we didn't really, we weren't privy to using any of his pedals and stuff, just the guitars and the amps that were there. But
well, that's cool.
Yeah.
I'll let Lori show that picture up, so I'm going to go ahead and play. This is the Hello, Turn Your Radio On, is the right one. So take a listen. This is interesting. This is a really, I like this song. It's a very interesting sound. Again, a totally different feel, different style.
Well, yeah, that was when I worked in Shakespeare's Sister. My partner, my ex-partner Siobhan, was she and I had very different musical tastes. That was kind of like my Mick Ronson tribute, because we were really big time into Bowie and T-Rex, and we kind of met in the middle with our tastes, but they were still quite different. I came from more of a musical purist background, but even though I still love T-Rex and I love Bowie, and she came more from a punk angle. She was in Bananarama,
yeah,
right? Siobhan Fahey, yeah. So, us two together.
That's this one, right?
Yes, that's Siobhan. Yeah, that's not the.
Now, I noticed that was the her approach to the group Shakespeare's Sister. Mm. Was it more? She was more keyboard, and you were more guitar. I'm just curious because
she didn't play an instrument. No.
Oh, okay.
I played.
Because this is a lot of keyboards.
I programmed the piano keyboard on it and played most of the guitars on it. But there were other things on it as well.
Oh, okay. But because there is guitar.
Yeah.
But I was just curious because this was a lot of keyboards.
Yeah.
Too, a lot of synth stuff.
Yeah.
Which was interesting. And it, of that time, was an interesting period.
Yeah, it was an experimental time. It was a time, again, of innovation. We had lost that innovation, and then it came back again, I think, in the 90s for alternative music. So that was a great experience. What we created was really unusual.
And then you doubled, or was that... Siobhan singing the main lead, or were you guys doubling that?
What we always did was, because she had a lower voice
octaves.
Than me. We always did octaves.
Yeah, your voice is so distinct, like I can just hear it. It's like, oh, that's Mars.
Yeah, I always did the higher, the higher helium vocals.
Helium, that's great.
Yes,
that's
inhaled a few balloons.
Where'd the name come from?
Shakespeare's Sister comes from a Smith song called Shakespeare's Sister. It's like an ode to the Smiths.
So that was interesting. Now, were you producing this, or you booked?
No, we did not produce this. A guy named Alan Mulder produced it, who went on to do some really incredible alternative rock and roll records of the 90s. But she and I wrote most of that second album together. But her husband, Dave Stewart, she was married to Dave from the Eurythmics for a while. They're not together anymore, but he was a big influence because he'd come over with these ideas. Hey, Marcy, I've got this great idea for this song. And he'd come over, and he actually started that idea for that song, and then we all worked on it together.
Mm-hmm. He didn't play on any of the album?
Yes, he played on a few things, but he kind of let us get on with it, and he was very nurturing. There's another song I don't think I gave you called Emotional Thing, and he was like, come on, Marcy, you can do the solo. Just do it. And I'm like, okay, Dave. And I was, at the time, I that was a while ago, so I was a little more insecure, but I managed to do something that was good enough to use. But he was very encouraging and wonderful to work with. He did play in a few things, like I said, but he went under a pseudonym because didn't want everybody to think that he was like some kind of Svengali and, you know, making us something that we weren't. But but he was very encouraging, and she and I wrote almost all the songs together. It was a concept album for that second album.
Mm-hmm.
We started together as equal partners and came up with most of it in my home studio.
Now, working at George's house, his home studio, was that a big room? Were you able to, or was it a kind of like a smaller studio? What was it like?
Oh, no, it's a big room. With a giant board. It had all these, like, I don't know the name. I can't remember the brand name of the board. My husband's going to go, you idiot. He'll probably type it in the...
Well, I remember seeing a video of them flying it in.
Right, they flew it in because
they couldn't get in, and they had to fly it through the window.
Oh, right. My goodness.
Yeah, it's a helicopter came and dropped
that's
it in.
That's right. It was crazy. It had all these crazy lit-up faders. You know, they were all different colors. And apparently...
Neve?
Huh?
Neve?
Was it Neve?
I don't think it was a Neve. I don't think so.
It'd be too Trident? Easy to remember.
Hmm?
Trident. I'm trying to think of all the British boards. Trident?
I don't think it was a Trident. No.
I don't think that was SSL back then. So there
definitely wasn't. It was an older.
All right, whoever's listening, type in the answer here. Or a prize.
My husband would probably know, but it was incredible. It was
so he had a big main room. He must have had an amazing collection of microphones.
Oh yeah, it was phenomenal. What an opportunity. I mean, if you would have told me that as a child that I'd be in George Harrison's house working on an album, I said, oh yeah.
Did he come in and listen?
You know what? He actually wasn't there while we were recording. Unfortunately, his wife was there, and
his son was there.
Yeah, his son Danny.
I gotta show this.
Yeah, show that. That's Danny. He came in. He used to hang out with us, and in fact, my husband Lance showed him how to skateboard, which he still remembers. Sweet kid, and he played guitar, and he plays great. Now he's got his own band going on, but. It was an incredible experience. But I had met him before that when I was working with Clapton. We were out in Malibu at the at Shangri-La. And we were doing one of the albums, one of Eric's albums out there. And I was in this, in the studio room, you know, in the big room. And I was playing the piano, working on a song. And George, the door opened and somebody said, keep it up. You'll be really good one day. And I turned around, and it was George Harrison. I nearly, like, I couldn't believe it. I was like, okay. Well, thank you.
It's either you don't stop playing or you never play again.
Yeah, right?
That's incredible.
Wonderful.
So crazy.
Well, I'm going to show another clip that I don't think this, it's called Ride. Is that on any... I don't know what album that's on.
It's not on an album yet. This is a new collection. So when I moved back into L.A. About 2 years ago, and I started working on a bunch of new songs, which I wanted to get back to my roots again, back to my bluesy kind of blues rock roots. And this is one of the songs that's just as a demo that you're going to play. But
it's
really
amazing
like
for
it.
A demo. But
thank you.
It shows that she stuck to it. And your guitar playing, she does the lead. She does all the guitars.
I played everything on it. I programmed it.
Okay.
I used Logic. And
let me play it. It speaks for itself. And this is an edit. I pulled the song's longer. But you'll see a little bit of what she's doing on some of the. She's doing some great fills with the rhythm guitar, and then there's a lead at the end, and this is cut together for that. So this is Ride. Take a listen to this. This is really cool.
We took a shot to the heart.
Now, there's some really cool things that are going
so
on in
good.
There. There's really, first of all, the first guitar, and then you're doing the fills. Mm-hmm. What was that? Which guitar was that?
I was using, I have a J. Turser, which is kind of like a Gibson 335. I used to own a Gibson 335. But now I have a Turser, which is very similar, and that's a guitar I use like for everything on that track. Mm-hmm. I'm playing the rhythm on that and everything.
And what amp were you using?
Actually, it's kind of embarrassing to say, but for people who are using software, I mean, when I use Logic, there are so many incredible plugins. I'm like, okay, what do I want? I want like a tweed sound, and I just kind of go through them until I find the sound that I want, or I'll add some low end or, you know, some kind of EQ until I get it sounding exactly what I want. I'll maybe add some reverb, or, you know, so they're all plugins.
Oh, okay. I mean, that's okay.
Yeah.
It was sounded great. I mean, that's a great sound.
And you get the demo you want, you know, so when you're ready to do the real thing, it's like, this is what I want it to sound like.
Right, exactly.
Right? Yeah,
so my
it.
Intention with this is to actually do it with, you know, a complete band. So it's not just me playing everything.
Like get Albert Lee on there.
Yeah, right?
But it was interesting, in the second area, when I cut to the second part where you're doing that other, you're doing the lead.
The solo, yeah.
There's another, there's the timbre changes. There's a guitar we were talking earlier because it has that kind of glassy sound like Dire Straits. Mm-hmm. And you're doing the tenths. What was that? Was that the same guitar?
Same guitar,
just
yeah.
a different plugin?
Yeah.
Okay. Because, I mean, it's just that glassy sounds to die for. That's a great, that's a great sound.
Yeah.
And then she's doing that while she's playing the other lead. So the two guitars interact really well.
Yeah.
So that's some great leads. I mean, you got tasty fills. Those tasty fills are great.
I think
George would be proud. So I think he would.
I've always wanted to play more solos, but it's just a question of, you know, this neck can be really intimidating if you don't really, you know, it's one thing to have an ear, but then it's another thing to really like put in the time to mm-hmm. to learn it and put it to use. And understand it. So I've been fortunate to play with some of the best guitarists of all time. So it's been kind of, you know, I've been inundated with some amazing playing, and it's, you know, what I want to hear and what I want to actually transfer mm-hmm. into my playing. Mm-hmm. You know?
No pressure,
right? Yeah.
So when you play both electric and acoustic, you're using fingers. You don't use picks?
You know what? I don't like picks. Because I feel like it takes me away from the feel. I want to feel the strings. Once in a while, I'll use a pick. But I had a manager once back in like the 90s, like, well, why are you using a pick? You need to use a pick. I mean, no, this is the way I play.
Right.
This is the way I play.
Well, now everybody's, even since Beck, I think Clapton doesn't use a pick anymore.
No?
I'm not sure, but I don't think he, I know Beck doesn't. And a lot of guitarists now are just using their fingers.
Well, and then
I mix. Sometimes they mix it up.
Sometimes they mix it up.
Well,
yeah.
Some of the guys, like some of the newer players, I say they use both, but a lot of the guys are, I know Beck is using his fingers.
Yeah.
And it sounds great. And another guy that always used fingers is Stephen Stills.
Right, and Johnny
gets
Guitar.
That tone.
Johnny Guitar Watson. I was watching some clips of him the other night, and I saw there was a really a close-up. He was using his thumb most of the time.
Yeah.
To, you know, accentuate.
Stills has a real long nail.
Right.
That. So he uses that for that. But, yeah. I mean, it definitely affects that sound.
Absolutely.
With the sound that he's
yeah.
doing. I told you we'd run out of time.
Oh,
we're out
God.
Of time.
We are.
Really, I wanted you to go ahead and play something to take us out just to show this beautiful guitar and just like a little solo spot. But before we do that, what's coming up for you? Anything that you want to talk about?
Well, I want to, you know, do a record of all this new stuff, which is my kind of my exploration back into the blues. So I'm working on that. I have some interest on that and a few other things.
You should mention the Housewives project.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know politically, though. You know, it's a political record that I was involved in, like a protest album. And I don't know how your listeners feel about.
Well, we had Lawrence on the show, so.
Oh, okay.
I was a big fan of Eve of Destruction. So, I mean, I think we need more protest songs. Cause it was
especially now, right?
Yes.
Did I say that?
But in general, I mean, just even before this administration, you need to. There's a lot of stuff going on that's been going on for a while that needs to be.
Free expression.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I did an album with Lawrence Juber and his wife, Hope Juber, and another a great singer named Roberta Freeman. I met Hope at the gym, when I moved into L.A. a few years ago, and then I realized who her husband was. I'm like, you're kidding, Lawrence Juber? I'm a huge fan. So we got together, and then, you know, the whole election thing was happening, and we were kind of very concerned about what was going on in our country. So we just started writing, you know, every day there was a new title. He would say something, go, oh, my God, well, we got to write a song about that. So Hope would send me this, you know, these ideas, and I would say, okay, and I'd put it to music or, you know, it just happened really naturally. So we did an album. It's the band's called The Nasty Housewives. The Nasty Housewives. Don't Google Nasty Housewives and you're going to see some porn. But The Nasty Housewives. There's a website. There's a Facebook page. Twitter.
And Hope is greatly talented.
She really is. She really is.
So impressed by her.
She is a great writer, and she is a great actress and singer as well. She's really, really quite a talent. Not to mention her husband. He's not shabby.
Oh, that's cool. I have to check
that
one.
Yeah, we had him on a couple times here.
Anything else coming up real quick?
A couple shows coming up. Actually, this Thursday I've got the Delgado Brothers. They're going to be back at Bogey's, and it's actually Stevie Delgado, the drummer and lead singer's birthday party, and there's still some room available. Come out to Bogey's. And then next Tuesday, two of your favorites. We've got Mark Leggett playing at Trip Bar, and then the Painkillers with Donnie Kirkpatrick, and I get to sit in and sing with those guys over at Trip in Santa Monica on the 12th.
Cool. Oh, very, very cool.
It'll be fun.
Well, I told you we didn't have enough time to cover. We just barely scratched the surface. This means you have to come back.
Yeah, I'd love to.
So we have to have you back.
Thank you.
Can I show any more of these pictures?
You can while we're...
me with an antenna on my head. I did my Feeler album, and I felt like I was channeling, you know, I was receiving, like, information.
Well, set up the song that you're going to take us out with and kind of set it up. Let us tell us a little bit about it.
It's another one off of this newest collection. It's kind of a political song. I think you figure it out when I play it.
Okay. All right. That's okay.
Doctor, doctor, we're all bleeding. Love's escaping. Time is fleeting. We're all blinded by bravado. Don't see the ego in the model. We're walking on a bed of nails. Walking on a bed. I'm laying on a bed of nails. I'm in so much pain. I don't know where it hurts. Surrounded by so many lies. I don't know which one's worse. Which one's worse? Now money is walking. And bullshit's talking. Sorry, kids, nothing's noticed unless it's shocking. Right is wrong, wrong is winning to the dark ages. We're all spinning, we're walking on a bed of nails, walking on a bed of. I see the future. I hear the fall. Devil is walking amongst us all. Amongst us all. Pain. I don't. like a bed of nails. It's like a bed of nails.
Good night, everybody.